Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Wings for Breakfast, our twice weekly Red Wings podcast on The Athletic, presented by BetMGM. I'm Max Boltman. With me, as always, is Prashant Iyer. Been a couple of Red Wings games since the last time we talked. One of them, a surprising 6-4 Red Wings win over the Tampa Bay Lightning. And one of them, a 2-1 unsurprising loss to the Carolina Hurricanes. Two of the NHL's best teams, two of the Central Division's best teams. Lately, those have been one and the same with the way that those two in Florida have gone. So, Prashant, what are you looking for in this run of play that the Red Wings have against some really top competition? And, you know, what are your kind of takeaways from what you've seen so far? You know, 1-2 overall, but I think 3 points so far in these first three games.
Yeah, I mean, we noted this maybe last week that this March schedule is going to be really telling for the Wings as they basically go and they basically alternated between Carolina and Tampa, and they still have, you know, Dallas coming up. And so this is kind of a murderer's row of a stretch, if you will, getting, you know, both Carolina and Tampa who've been outstanding in Dallas, who is slowly finding their groove, but obviously the finalist last year. And so, you know, through the first three games, I mean, in the being able to take Tampa to overtime in that first one, going 4-3 there, and then coming back and actually scoring a season-high 6 goals in the second game against Tampa, in a game that, you know, arguably they didn't really control play, but they just happened to get the breaks. I think, I can't remember which Lightning player said it, but it was basically saying they capitalized on every break they got. And that was the kind of game that I thought the Red Wings really had to play this entire season. And then, you know, coming back, and while the score was close in their game, first game there against Carolina, a 2-1 loss, you know, Carolina did carry, I think, a majority of the play. But really the moral of the story, I think, for what you're looking for is, unlike last year, at least keep the score close. At least don't get blown out. Don't, you know, allow yourself to fall behind by 3-4 goals and take those kinds of blowouts. And, you know, three games here and you've got a 1-goal loss in overtime, a 2-goal win and a 1-goal loss that, you know, came down the last few that came down the last period. So overall, kind of an encouraging sign, if you ask me.
Yeah, I thought it was fine. I mean, the win over the Lightning is a big assist to Curtis McElhinney, who I did not think was very good. I mean, the Red Wings had 3 goals very early in that one. Was it in the first period?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was 3-2 at the end of the first period, because I remember this because I wasn't actually watching the game, but I was getting score updates on my phone, and it just kept going off in the first period. I was like, there's something malfunctioning here. This is not a I must have, like, set it for the Hurricanes game or something like that instead of the Red Wings one. And sure enough, it was 3-2 at the end of the first period.
Yeah, not only have there been plenty of games this season where the Red Wings haven't scored 3 goals, there have been some games this season where both teams combined, the Red Wings and their opponent, have only scored or just barely scored 3 goals. One of them against Carolina the other night. So to see the Red Wings score 3 goals in one period immediately will get your attention. But I want to say it was like 3 on their first, I don't know if it was 5.
I think it was first 5 shots, because I saw a screen grab where the shots were 15-5 Tampa and Detroit had 3 goals. And so just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, you know, just literally capitalizing on every chance, obviously not getting great goaltending from McElhinney, but still, that's what Detroit had to do.
It's what they had to do, and it's the kind of style that they have leaned into all year long. I mean, it's a real, and I do respect it. You know, it's a real understanding of what you have and how you need to play, and I think the buy into it has, you know, on the whole, been pretty good. They've gotten away from it a couple times, and you end up chasing the play, and that's kind of a byproduct of some of it. But this is the kind of outcome you can sometimes get when you play this way. And so it's not the only way to win a game in this league, but it's seems to be the way that works the best for the Red Wings. And so that's how that one kind of played out. I thought Philip Zadina had a couple more assists, I think, in that game. That was an encouraging sign for him. Filip Hronek had a couple of assists. He became the Red Wings points leader for the season in that game. Those are kind of the stats, not the stats risers, but the key kind of narrative elements is that Philip Zadina, that capped a really strong run of play for him. I didn't think he was quite as good against Carolina on Sunday night, at least on the puck. I mean, he had wasn't maybe the most careful game he's had with the puck, but that certainly did not just apply to him. That was a Red Wings, you know, endemic problem. all night. And then Hronek, I thought he made one of his better plays in the season in that Tampa game to set up Dylan Larkin. I don't know if you caught a replay of that goal, but he takes a quick head check, shoulder check going into the corner, fires one to the front of the net. Larkin doesn't get all of it, but he got enough of it to put it in. And so if you're a Red Wings fan, you're probably pretty pleased with both of those two guys coming out of that game.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just going back and taking a peek through the stats there, I mean, they were two of Detroit's better players. And honestly, that's what you want to see, you know, from the Red Wings for the growth, because, you know, the wins aren't always going to be there. The goals aren't always going to be there. But when they are there, you do want to see it coming from those younger guys that you expect to be a part of the future there. But, you know, honestly, the Wings got a huge break with Curtis McElhinney. I think it was, what, five goals at 5-on-5 yes. that he gave up on only 16 shots against. So you're not going to get too many times where you get a goalie posting a sub 70% save percentage. So definitely take full advantage there.
Yes. So then they had a day off. They had a practice day. Then they go, they host Carolina. And that was a much different kind of game. I mean, this was, I still believe that Tampa Bay is the best team in the league. And they have a great blue line. They really do. But I am really coming around to the idea that Carolina's is the best blue line in the league. I was marveling all night at the way that those guys defend. They're huge. They're mobile. They very rarely let you into you know, prime space. And they can all chip in. I mean, I think it was Dougie Hamilton that had the shorthanded goal.
Yep.
You're talking about a 6'6 defenseman getting up ice for a shorthanded goal. And oh, by the way, he's like on a blue line with basically clones of himself at this point. I mean, Dougie Hamilton is on a little higher pedestal. I would put Slavin in the same tier as him. But then you still got Pesci. You've still got Brady Shea, who's turned into a nice player. I really like Jake Bean, what he's done so far in the NHL. I am just blown away by what Carolina's defense corps, you know, is composed of and how well they work together. It's so impressive.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about Dougie Hamilton joining the rush to score a shorthanded goal there. And that's really been the MO of the Hurricanes penalty kill the whole season, is they're just this ultra aggressive penalty kill. And the Red Wings really got a full taste of that. I mean, I think they really struggled with the end zone pressure to really set up and things like that. But then to not only, you know, struggle with that pressure, but to have a defenseman of Dougie Hamilton's kind of caliber be able to come back, transition up the ice on a 2-on-1, and then do a little curl and drag as Larkin's trying to slide at him, you know, with his stick like outstretched, and then fire a wrist shot past Bernier. I mean, it's incredible stuff. I think Dougie Hamilton's on like a 9-game point streak right now. I mean, just next level stuff. And it really illustrates their depth when Jake Gardner is their taxi squad defenseman. Like that's yeah. the level of depth that you have in Carolina right now. So really, really scary defensive blue line. I didn't actually think Carolina played particularly well, you know, relative to a lot of their other games that I've seen. And that's partly terrifying, but that's also a testament to how Detroit has really, I think aside from the one game where Carolina kind of beat them 5-2, I think Detroit has actually been able to hang with the Canes for the most part and not necessarily allow their high-octane offense to really, really get unleashed. And so I think you saw a little bit more of that again, you know, in the last game. And I think the Wings have to be at least a little bit encouraged by that.
Yeah, I mean, what I kept noticing is aside from way too many odd man rushes they gave up, which they did give up way too many odd man rushes, especially maybe not ironically with the way things have gone this year on Detroit power plays, Carolina was getting too many odd man rushes. But aside from that, what impressed me is the way that the Red Wings, both forwards and defensemen, really forced Carolina to take their shots from enough distance that Jonathan Bernier was able to make some not necessarily easy saves, but some important saves. One of his better saves of the night came off of a stanchion in the corner off a weird hop that he fielded like a shortstop fielding the scorching ground ball. But, you know, so I thought Jonathan Bernier was very good again, as he has been really for the bulk of this season. I gave him a B+ in my midseason grades, and people said I should have gave him an A, and I think they might be right. I might have overreacted to a couple games right before I was writing them that he gave up four in a couple games in a row, and that might be my bad. Bernier's been really good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that's the one I texted you about right after you published. I said, all right, your Bernier grade. You know, if anybody was going to get an A on this team, it would be Jonathan Bernier. I mean, You know, even after these games against Carolina and Tampa, he is eighth in the NHL in 5-on-5 expected goals saved above average. Like, this is ridiculous. I mean, you watch the Detroit defense. You see some of the chances they give up. You see how much Thomas Grace, a goaltender who is outstanding in his own right and has been the last few years, is struggling to adapt to playing behind this team. Jonathan Bernier is the human eraser. I mean, he has been in the top 10 going all the way back to December of 2019 in his ability to save shots that should go in. And so, you know, he is what allows Detroit to be successful in the system they're going to play. Because, you know, we're talking about them playing this bend don't break system. We're talking about them trying to be tight through the neutral zone. It really only works because of Jonathan Bernier. It works because he covers up the mistakes. It works because he's able to be that last line of defense. I mean, you know, you can say a couple of those were luck saves, the couple of, you know, knob saves off of his stick, you know, on Svechnikov, and I think it was Slavin in the first period. I mean, those are saves. Maybe you call a little lucky, but at the end of the day, he makes those saves. He keeps them in it, and he gives them a chance to win, and he really gives them a chance, like in that Tampa game, of, hey, if they capitalize on all their breaks, you can beat this team. You can beat these guys. I mean, at one point, I think Detroit was up 5-2, and really the score only looks close because Tampa scored a couple goals in the last couple of minutes, but he is the human eraser. So really just unbelievable level of play over the last year plus.
I'll tell you what my calculus was I didn't want to give any A's on an 8-win team. And that might be a little pig-headed thinking, determining the outcome before I went through the process. And what ultimately kind of what I've been reflecting on with this is that they're an 8-win team and Jonathan Bernier is a 7-win goalie. And I hate goalie wins as a stat, but it's not like he's a below 500 goalie. He is somehow at or above. I don't know if he might be at now, but like he's above 500.
No, he's 7-6. He's 7-6 on a team with 8 wins. That's in the
I fucked up. I get it.
Like, it's just, it's unreal. Like, if you just compare to what Grice, Pickard, Howard, Eric Comrie for a game have done, and then you look at Bernier, there's a reason there's been a total of 3 wins by a goalie not named Jonathan Bernier going back to the start of last season.
Oh, that's 3 wins. Crazy stat.
3. 2 of them by Jimmy Howard that happened before Halloween of 2019. And the 1 Thomas Grace win. Those are the 3 wins. That's it. So it's just I can't even fathom how he's done this, but it's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous.
I'll take the L. I deserve it. The other thing I was going to say about the Carolina game is I did think the Larkin line matched up pretty well all together. I mean, they always get tough matchups. And Anthony Mantha gets the goal late with the empty net. It goes off a skate, not the prettiest goal in the world. But I thought that group of him, Mantha, and Fabry, all told, still had a pretty good day.
Yeah, I mean, they matched up against the Sebastian Aho line, which is a heck of a line. I think it was Aho, Natchez, and Niederreiter. That line and the defense pairing behind him was Pesci and Shea. And with Aho on the ice and Dylan Larkin on the ice, the Red Wings controlled 80% of the shots taken. That's not something that happens to Sebastian Aho very often, to, you know, be able to control the level of play and really limit the Aho line in 10 minutes of ice time to just 3 shot attempts. So I think you have to be really, really pleased with how well that line played, controlled the offense, generated their own chances, and really limited arguably Carolina's top line to very little. And that's what allowed the Wings to stay so competitive in that game.
When we talk about Dylan, and we've talked about this a lot on the show in the past, when we've talked about Dylan Larkin's evolution as a defensive center, I think this is part of it that is really interesting, because you can watch Larkin and you can see him compete for pucks. So you can see him kind of smother guys. You can see him throw little jabs and stalls on guys to just slow him down, throw him off just enough. But honestly, the thing that makes Dylan Larkin a very good and potentially elite defensive center is when he has games like this where the best defense is having the puck. The best defense is winning battles in the opponent's defensive end so that they never break the puck up ice, because you don't want to see Sebastian Aho in transition, right? You want to see Dylan Larkin winning that race in the plus corner. And even if he's not scoring, which he didn't last night, I think he had several shots, but nothing crazy dangerous. He had one that I thought Nedeljkovic put a really good pad save on. That's still great. This was, I would term, a great defensive performance by Larkin, even without that one game-saving back check, because what did you do? You held one of the game's most dynamic young centers to three shot attempts.
Yeah, and sometimes people say, okay, well, the numbers say this. What is it on the ice that they're doing? And Max, I think you kind of illustrated it. I think number one, they do a really nice job winning puck battles in the offensive zone. So Larkin is absolutely tenacious as a forechecker. I think Anthony Mantha is very underrated as a forechecker. I don't think people give him enough credit for how well he's able to seal along the boards, for how well he uses his stick, how well he positions himself to take away passing lanes when he's the F3 that's up high. I think he does a really nice job in that realm and makes outlets more difficult than they need to be. And then I think when you're watching this team defend in transition, there's always that back pressure. Fabry's a great skater. Larkin's a great skater. Mantha, when he's got his legs moving and he's got his stick in position, takes away so much ice. And then as soon as they recover the puck in their own zone, they break out of their zone so well. And so that's why I think they do a really nice job against these types of lines, because they are so good and so aggressive in all three phases and really all three zones of the ice that it makes it very difficult to play against them.
Yeah. And I just really like him and Mantha together. I know that they think Mantha can drive his own line too. And that's a useful thing to be able to do. But when I watch him, I just think those two play off each other well. Maybe Mantha has the puck a little less when he's with Larkin. And, you know, you certainly want the puck in Anthony Mantha's hands a lot, especially when he's going. But we even saw against Tampa, you know, they were on a line there. And I thought Anthony Mantha had the puck plenty. He created a lot in that game.
Yeah. And I mean, I think I've probably been one of the largest proponents of splitting that line up. But, you know, at the end of the day, you see what happens when they play together. They really are dynamic. And Tyler Bertuzzi's the third part of that trio. And when he's back, fully suspect that you have that line reunited, because at the end of the day, they just control so much when they're on the ice together that it's worthwhile to maybe take 20 minutes of them being dominant as opposed to trying to draw even over 40 minutes. And in particular, I think when you look at a team like Boston, they've been able to do this with Marchand and Bergeron for years and years and years. And maybe that's kind of the model that Detroit needs to take when they're building their team.
So the Red Wings lose last night 2-1. They'll play again Tuesday evening at LCA. After the game on Sunday night, a little bit of news breaks that Donovan Sobrango, Red Wings' third round pick from this most recent 2020 draft, has signed his ELC. He's obviously playing in the AHL right now, waiting for the OHL to start. He will have to go back to the OHL once that happens. The ELC is for next year, so he will have to go back to the AHL or OHL once that happens. But I believe this makes Sobrango the first member of the 2020 class to sign. And I just wanted to see what you make of him signing already. I mean, I think it's been positive reviews from what I've heard in Grand Rapids. Obviously, he made a run at Team Canada's World Junior team. I put him in my stock up category when we did Prospect Watch, but I wanted to get your opinion on Sobrango signing and how significant should people view this?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly encouraging, because that should tell you that the Red Wings are somewhat pleased with his level of play in the AHL. And as a result, they do think he'll be, in the neighborhood of maybe being an NHL player in the next handful of years. I kind of liken it back to, the career path that Gustav Lindstrom had to a certain extent, where he kind of moved a little bit faster than I think a lot of people expected him to relative to where he was drafted back in the third round of the 2017 draft. I mean, he, very quickly signed his ELC and was able to join the Red Wings, in last season. And you have to wonder maybe if Sobrango's on a similar timeline there. He's 19. I think that'll be his ELC signing age, which means You'll be able to slide the contract 1 year. So you can effectively think of this as, you know, being under team control for arguably 4 years. So I would expect that, you know, maybe you don't see him this year or next year, just given the NHL-CHL agreement, but potentially the year after that. So talking about 2022, 2023 might be the first time you're looking at him making the roster with an outside shot.
Yeah. No, I think that's a good timetable. I mean, really what it tells you is, you know, the Red Wings don't have to sign anyone they draft. Obviously, you're going to sign your first round pick. You're probably going to sign most of your second round picks over the course of, you know, a few years. But beyond that, you don't have to sign anyone. I mean, there was a class not too long ago, and you don't want to replicate this too often, where the Red Wings had like 4 third round picks, and I don't believe signed any of them. Is that 2016, 2017 with Cocconsalo and all those guys?
Yeah, I think it was the 2016 draft, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, so I think they can still sign Cocconsalo this year, but I just don't expect them to. And so, you know, there are years where you can have a ton of third round picks and not sign any of them. And so I think it is meaningful when you see a third round pick signed this early. It really tells you, because you have a limit of how many contracts you can have signed. And so using one of them on a kid you just drafted in the third round should tell you that this is a kid that the Red Wings have some hopes for and believe in. I mean, they signed Johansson only after, they had to wait till after last season, but you know, they signed him after last season. You know, they'll presumably sign both Lucas Raymond and Jonathan Berggren at the end of this NHL season. But you know, that just kind of shows you, right? They hadn't even signed Berggren yet. And so, I think it's a, you know, it's not a sign that Sabrango is going to be a top pair guy. Like, don't run too wild with it. It just tells you that they've seen something that they like in him playing at the pro level at age 18, that they seem to believe that this is on a good trajectory is what I would read into that.
Yeah, and that's honestly the furthest extent you should go to reading into that. And so to clarify, it was actually the 17 draft, because I'm misremembering where Lindstrom was drafted. He was drafted in the second round, and then the third round, that was where, you know, everything kind of fell apart for the Wings. That was your Kasper Cocconsalo draft. That's
Lane Zablocki. They could still sign
Keith Petruzzelli's in that draft, and then Zach Gallant is in that draft. But you know, probably not seeing any of those top three guys. You'll probably still see Petruzzelli sign this year as well. But I mean, I think with Lindstrom, you know, he signed. He was very quickly in the NHL. I think he signed when he was 20. You know, Sabrang was signing here with his age being 19. That does offer that year of flexing, but I think maybe 3 years from the draft is when you would expect to see him. So, and again,
at the earliest,
And again, you know, that doesn't tell you anything about quality, ceiling, caliber. Just tells you they think he's on the right path to being an NHL defenseman.
Yep, I agree with that completely. Don't read into it too much about his overall prospect status. Just that it's a good sign about how it's gone since the draft. Which, if you've been reading Prospect Stock Watch, you might have already known. All right, moving on to the topic. I had a story come out today that's kind of our rumblings column, I guess you would call it, what I'm hearing about the Red Wings at the deadline. One of the topics in there was about reasonable returns for Luke Glendening and Bobby Ryan. And I think by extension, you can kind of infer some things about the market overall. I can actually just tell you some things about the market overall. There is a lot of uncertainty about how busy it's going to be for all the reasons I think we've talked about in the past. One thing I focused on in this story is that one of the things the Red Wings have going for them is that a couple of their, and actually several of their tradable players are on short, cheap contracts. And that, I think, is important this year. It's probably going to be the bigger the contract, you know, the more motivated a team's going to have to be to take it on because of the flat cap, because of the financial restraints, and because it just is harder to justify bringing in somebody for a draft pick if you don't know if you can get that home playoff revenue if you fall short of the cup. So I think that's a good thing the Red Wings have going for them. Also, certainly they have the cap space if they wanted to retain a little bit of that. And if they're talking about picks and prospects, it does kind of stand to reason that one thing a team that they're trading with wouldn't have to give up is a roster player. Like, if they're getting a pick or a prospect, the team that they're trading with doesn't have to lose a roster player while they wait for whichever Red Wing they traded for to quarantine and join their team. in whatever capacity that might be. It's different in different places. So that was one thing. And then I talked a little bit about the prices that I kind of expect and have gotten a sense would be considered reasonable, would be considered a great get for Glendening and Bobby Ryan. And I've kind of, I think based on what I can infer, it seems like a third or a fourth is kind of the range that is maybe most reasonable for those guys. I think if they got a second, that would be looked at as them doing really, really well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's really interesting. Like we talked about in the last episode, what this deadline's going to be like and what it's going to look like. I think, you know, Max, I think you're spot on in that overall, it's going to be maybe a quieter deadline than what we've come accustomed to. And I also think, you know, maybe the makeup of the player might be different. You know, you kind of alluded to teams not really wanting to, you know, make cross-border deals. Like we saw some of the issues, I think you highlighted it in your article with the Patrick Laine, Pierre, Luc Dubois deal, having the flat cap, not necessarily being able to spend freely as much as, you know, as teams are kind of accustomed to, given how much revenue has been lost. So I think a couple things that stand out to me is one, I think, you know, like you said, draft picks are going to be the commodity that contending teams are maybe more willing to deal to bring on a player if they're worried about potentially losing someone for a period of time. You know, on the flip side, you can argue that they would want to make more salary neutral deals and not necessarily want to take salary on. But I think it'll weigh out. I think the competitive desire will weigh out for some of these teams. The other thing that kind of stands out to me is I wonder if there will be a market for players under contract beyond this year.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, you know, hopefully with the way the vaccine rollout's gone, we're potentially talking about next season not having the same level of COVID restrictions, and that you're potentially having, you know, fans back in the building, revenues being back. Obviously, yes, teams took a hit for a while, but are they more willing to spend on a player that they're going to have under contract for the following year as opposed to our typical UFA rental that we're accustomed to seeing dealt? Either way, you know, if Glendening and Ryan are called, yeah, I think thirds and fourths are kind of what you're going to be expecting. I think maybe more of a third for Bobby Ryan, maybe more of a fourth for Luke Glendening is what I would consider, you know, reasonable value in my mind. But anything more than that, if you could upsell as much as you can if the team's willing to part with it.
The eternal caveat is that it only takes one team to really fall in love with a player, to really decide he's their missing piece, to decide that, you know, this is the guy who gets us over the top. And that can be true for any of these guys. And so if that person emerges, then, you know, the price, you know, I don't take this, you know, that I'm telling you right here as kind of gospel for what I would expect as prices. It only takes one team to think differently. That's what you see in the draft every year too, is you can see as many lists as you want of this is where, you know, guys should go. This is how I would rank them. This is how the scouting community ranks them, whatnot. And then every year there are guys who surprise and jump up. And that's because if one team thinks you're their guy, that's all you need. And so that certainly applies here. And I think that's important to note. It's just, I think it's important as you calibrate your expectations to do it reasonably and not be disappointed then, I guess, when that first round pick doesn't come, or maybe there's no second round picks in this group this year. That I think that's possible.
Yeah,
so I think it's just important as an expectation setter.
It really only takes one Nashville to go throw a first round pick at Paul Gostad, right?
Sure.
You know, it takes one team to do it. I mean, you highlighted the Pageau deal last year. That was very surprising. I mean, I think everyone was blown away a couple years ago when Detroit got a first, second, and a third for Thomas Tatar.
That's right.
From Vegas. I mean, that was a lot more than people thought they would get for Tatar. Even more value than I thought they would get for Tatar. So, you know, it just takes one team to be willing to spend and be aggressive. Whether or not we get that team will be another story. And then I think the other caveat that's going to go into this trade deadline is, do you have teams making deals ahead of the expansion draft, recognizing that they may lose some players, or they may want to acquire some players that they could potentially protect or not have to protect or allow to be exposed, or any way to kind of circumvent, you know, what did these teams learn from the Vegas expansion draft? And will you see certain teams? I mean, Carolina's a team where they're potentially walking into the expansion draft with Brady Shea, Hayden Fleury, and Jake Bean exposed. And do you want to lose one of those three guys for absolutely nothing, or are you going to try and make a deal and get something in return? So I think that'll be the other thing to definitely consider here.
Yeah. All right. I think that's a good point. I mean, does anybody stand out? I don't know. I don't want to put you on the spot too much here on that point, but does any team stand out as having a really obvious expansion draft situation that is something they could look to solve in the interim between now and then? I mean, there's some teams, a lot of teams that have those situations are contenders. And so they're balancing. They don't want to subtract in the middle of a cup run, of a middle of a playoff run. And maybe might prefer to do that in the off season if possible. But sometimes there's teams that are somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah. I mean, I just highlighted Carolina. I think they're definitely going to be one.
Yeah.
You know, Tampa's going to have an interesting situation because they do have three no move clauses. They're good. Obviously, they're guys they'd protect anyways, and Kucherov, Stamkos, and Hedman. But Kucherov was a guy they were trying to unload, you know, earlier. They'll probably be able to get away with Kucherov, Stamkos, you know, Point, Cirelli. And then they're going to have some interesting decisions on who they're going to end up exposing and what they're going to do the rest of the way. And they also have a really good D core where they might, you know, have some difficult choices to make. I think Colorado is another team that's absolutely loaded with a lot of different guys. They may end up in a scenario where a Tyson Yost is exposed. And again, he plays lower in the lineup for them. But, you know, that might be an interesting one. And then their D core as well, you know, Kyle Makar, Sam Girard, Devin Taves, you know, they're going to be in a scenario where there's four guys right there, and you're going to only be able to protect likely three of them if they go with the 7-3-1. So do you have a way to make a deal for a Devin Taves, a Ryan Graves, a Sam Girard, because they have to protect Eric Johnson with his no move clause? So a lot of, you know, really interesting scenarios I think are going to exist for some of the contenders right now.
One thing we ran out of time for last episode that I want to kind of circle back on today is we had planned to do a little bit more of a dive into some guys in Sweden. We had certainly early this season spent a ton of time on the Red Wings Swedish pipeline and how everybody over there was faring, but it felt like we hadn't checked in kind of writ large with that group in a while. And so I wanted to do some checking in on Sweden. I mean, it is a little tough because Lucas Raymond's been out now with an injury for a couple weeks. Rogla hasn't been playing all that much. I mean, the Sweden schedule right now is kind of wild. Like, it's usually a very predictable Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday schedule, and you'll have the odd game here or there on a different day. Today, it feels like half the days I wake up and I check Flash Score, and you know, there's a SHL game going on. I assume these are all like makeup games or postponement games that they're trying to get in before the playoffs start. So I haven't seen Rogla play a ton lately or seen that they are playing a ton lately. But when I look at Moritz Seider's kind of moving average of shot share on Svengelska Hockey, which is Zach Ellenthal's site that I would highly encourage all of you to check out, it just keeps moving up and up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Rogla's next game, I think, will be the 19th. So you've got a couple of days before we get there. But I mean, you know, between the visualizations you see on Svengelska Hockey and some of the random stuff that I throw out there, I mean, Moritz Seider is arguably the best player in the SHL right now and arguably should win best defenseman, should be in consideration for MVP there. Obviously, those award races aren't really as like highly followed as they are over in the NHL. But either way, I think he belongs in the conversation there. I mean, what he's done is just ridiculous, to put it simply.
Yeah. Albert Johansson, we talked about, I do think we got to quite a bit on the last show as we were doing Prospect Risers. He's closing strong again this year. Jonathan Berggren hasn't been on the score sheet as much. Anything standing out to you in his profile or how the end of the season's going for him? It's not like he's not scoring at all, but it's just we kind of got accustomed to seeing Jonathan Berggren on the score sheet once, if not twice, just about every time you looked. And now he's dipped down to where it's more, I think he's at about 0.9 now, where he was at or above a point per game for the whole year.
Yeah, I mean, he's tailed off a little bit, which I think you were going to expect to a certain degree, just given very few guys his age can score at that rate. I mean, he's still north of 1.7 primary points per 60, you know, at even strength, which is a really strong number to be at. I mean, he's still an absolutely outstanding player. I think what I'm most impressed with him is when he's on the ice, His hockey team is scoring 60% of the goals at even strength, and he's actually controlling play to a certain extent at 5-on-5, which is not something we really saw or were or at least I wasn't expecting to see from him, given that he hadn't necessarily been touted as a play-driving winger. But, you know, his 5-on-5 Corsi 4% is 53% on the season, which is really, really solid. So overall, I think even if he's not showing up on the score sheet, he is still driving play when he's on the ice for his team.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Berggren too, part of the situation is he, as a playmaker, maybe it's never quite totally in his kind of control too. Like sometimes when you're the setup man, sometimes your teammate, you know, finishes the play, sometimes they don't. I think everyone in the Red Wings would love to see Jonathan Berggren score some more goals, but I also think that, isn't he in double digits now for this season?
In terms of goals? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and for a player of his kind of style in about 45 games, 10 goals is still pretty solid. Like, I don't think you can expect him to come over here and be really even a 20-goal guy. He's going to make his money on assists. And so I do wonder if maybe the points are a little less in his control here than maybe like a Lucas Raymond, for example, who I think does it every which way.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a great point to bring up with guys who are great, you know, passers and have really great, you know, vision. You are absolutely reliant on the finishing talent of your teammates. I mean, there are certain assists where you can serve things up on a platter, but you know, if you're not getting the finishing ability from your teammates, you're just not going to end up with the point totals.
Yeah. All right. Who are we missing? Theodor Niederbach and Elmer Soderblom. I have checked recently, and it has seemed like they are regulars in for London now. Both of them, I think, at various times this year have kind of been the 13th forward. I think the last time I looked, maybe they were playing with Carl Henriksen on the fourth line of all young guys in Frölunda. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, not a bad way to be for them, right? I mean, especially those guys getting a couple of opportunities to play more regularly on the big club, especially Soderblom, I think really stands out to me as an interesting guy because I don't know that anyone necessarily expected him to be a regular with the big club this season. I think his progression has been really, really fun to watch because it's so unexpected. I think a lot of people saw the guy at his size and said, okay, definitely has some talent here, but you know, what's he going to be able to contribute in the long run? And in reality, you're seeing him sitting here with a 5-on-5 Corsi 4 percentage of 58%, scoring 5 points already at 5-on-5 in addition to what he does on the power play. Heck of a hockey player. And then Niederbach stepping in his 17 games, he's at 59% from a 5-on-5 Corsi 4 percentage. And so both of them, I think, have, you know, really taken advantage of their small but opportunity that they've gotten with the big club this year.
You know, I think everyone's heard my Elmer Soderblom spiel before about wondering, you know, kind of what would translate, and especially around the World Juniors when he was doing it against men. And he just keeps doing it. I mean, I expected the World Juniors was going to be a situation that he was able to dominate because these are, you know, at the oldest, right, 20, more likely 19 year olds. Actually, they're all 19 at that tournament until maybe the very end, someone could turn 20, like on like January 1st or something and be 20 for the quarterfinals. But he goes back to the SHL and you see the way that he's using his body, using his skill, which is very good for his size against men. And it's working in one of the best leagues in the world. And it just gets harder and harder to find why he doesn't make it. I still think you're probably going to point to the feet if there is something holding him back. But, you know, I think the Red Wings are happy with how his skating's coming along. And so, I just think he's answering more and more questions. Their Ice Hockey GIFs is a great account to follow on Twitter. I don't know if they're like a Red Wings specific account, but I often see them tweeting highlights and clips of different Red Wings shifts. They're not all the goals and assists either. Sometimes they show you some of the really crucial shifts that don't lead to the score sheet, and this usually don't make it onto like the kind of highlight reel that you'd see over here. So I think it's a really valuable resource, and they had a really good one from Soderblom a couple days ago that I think is really worth watching to just show how he uses two things. That's his size and reach and his hands to be a really effective player in the offensive zone.
Yeah, and that's what really separates, I think, the big guys who make it to the NHL and then the big guys who later don't, is the guys, I mean, they're not going to be necessarily blazing fast guys, but if you know how to position yourself, use your frame, use your size, use your stick to take away passing lanes, something that I think Mantha does really, really well that doesn't get talked about enough, you're going to make it in this league, because just think about the radius that these guys can defend. And if they know what they're doing, they're smart enough to see it, they see the play happening, they can be an absolute nightmare to play against. That's why you have so many hockey GMs, you know, lusting after these big mobile defensemen. It's because if you get a guy that knows how to play that way with that frame, you are in business. You get Victor Hedman, you're going to win Stanley Cups. Like, that's just what happens. And so that's why there's that pursuit, that chase. It's, you can do it with the smaller guys, absolutely. But if you can find the guys that are like the Victor Hedmans, the Chris Prongers, that's what the ideal defenseman is like, because of the reach they can play with. Same thing goes for forwards and their ability to defend through the neutral zone. So I think he could be a very interesting guy to continue to watch, because he continues to succeed at the different levels.
Yeah. No, so I think you know, he's been a guy who, the more you see it against men, just the more confident you can be, and I, you know, I think it, you'd have a really hard time finding significant fault with Soderblom's season, especially down the stretch here.
Yeah, I mean, you can't fault him. He's gone through multiple different levels here and succeeded at all of them, and now is, you know, playing for the big league, or for the big club. I mean, he's getting about 10 minutes a night at 5-on-5, not a whole lot, but, you know, that's still a very solid role to have carved out for a guy that was a late round pick.
I mean, and Frölunda is just a hard team to get ice with. I mean, part of this is that Lucas Raymond's injury enabled this for both of these two guys, Niederbach and Soderblom. It just opens up more time on the wings, and both of those are wings. No pun intended.
That was absolutely intended.
Let's go to the mailbag.
Yeah.
All right. So this one is from Zdeno Churo, and he says, do you believe Dylan Larkin is the long-term answer at 1C?
Oh, I mean, I'm certain we'll disagree here, but my answer is no. I think he's very good, very capable. Can he play as a 1C? Sure, you're seeing that, and you've seen that the last couple of years. But if you want to be a Stanley Cup contending team, arguably, I believe you have to have at least one center as good, if not better, than Larkin for you to be able to be a consistent Cup contender.
I don't think we're going to disagree as much as you thought. I think Dylan Larkin is a 1C in the definition of the 30 best centers in the National Hockey team. I put him pretty comfortably in there. I think he's somewhere in that late teens to early 20s range for me among centers, and I think that makes him a 1C. But where we agree wholeheartedly is that you need two guys who are in at least that top, I would say probably 25 centers in the NHL to win a cup. And you really want one who's more like in that top 10 or so. And so from that standpoint, I think that it's unlikely that Dylan Larkin will be the best center on a contender. I think it's possible he might play the most minutes as a center on the next Red Wings Cup team. Like, I could see him taking on, you know, still a 21-minute-a-night role, while maybe a more offensive-minded guy or a younger guy takes 18, 19 with kind of a more, scoring-focused role, whereas Larkin, I think what he's proven so well to be able to do is to do exactly what he did to Aho, and that's play hard matchups and usually win them, not just by defending, but by also, you know, playing with the puck in the O-zone, by scoring some goals. And I think he will continue to do that for the foreseeable future in Detroit. So is he going to be the most used center on a contender? I think that's very possible. But is he going to be the highest scoring center on a contender? Increasingly, I think maybe not.
That's bold. Top 18 to 20 centers?
No, I said high teens to early 20. I mean, I think 18 to 23. I don't know, somewhere in there.
All right.
I might be wrong. I'd have to go through and look. But I mean, top 30 though, right? Like,
I think that's also bold. I don't know. Maybe top 30, not bold, but top 30 might be stretching it for me.
I think he's top 30 easy. And I would say it's probably more like, maybe late teens is a little bold, because I probably do, as I'm going through the league, I probably skip over some situations where two teams have two top 15 guys. Like, that's your, your Pittsburgh, that's your Tampa situation.
Edmonton.
I'm trying to think of other ones around the league, but I think it's probably around low 20s to yeah, I think it's top 30.
All right. Let me get a barometer here. So, okay. Yeah. Would you rather have Dylan Larkin or Bo Horvat?
I would take Larkin.
You take Larkin over Bo Horvat. All right. Okay. That's my barometer there. I think those guys are roughly.
I don't think it's a bad comp though, in terms of the dynamic between Horvat and Pettersson.
Like, yeah.
I would say Larkin's a little better than Horvat, so you don't need quite Pettersson to make that same dynamic. But I think Pettersson's a top 5 or 6 center in the NHL.
I mean, like, Pettersson's there. I mean, he's very clearly there. More just like, I think Horvat's probably right around the skill level of the guy that I'm thinking about there. But I think you'd be surprised at the number of teams that have multiple really good centers. I mean, we haven't talked about Florida and Huberto and Barkov. You haven't talked about...
Well, Huberto plays on the wing.
But he can play center, and he has been a center.
Well, okay, then we have to we have to filter those out then.
All right, fair enough. I'll give you that. Like,
yeah, I mean, I like, you know, when Datsyuk and Zetterberg were on a line, you couldn't tout the Red Wings center depth if they were using one of those guys on the wing. You know what I mean?
Fair. I'll give you that. But, you know, there's other teams like Winnipeg, right? With Dubois. No,
Winnipeg has great centers. Yeah, I would put Larkin and Pierre-Luc Dubois on even ground is about what I would say.
Interesting. Okay.
That's how I view Larkin. I mean, maybe that's a little high. Maybe some people would argue it's a little low. I mean, but I view them on pretty even ground. So I would view, and I really like Mark Scheifele. I don't know that I see Scheifele as like unattainably better than Pierre-Luc Dubois and Dylan Larkin either, although he has scored more than either of them at any point have.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think this is a topic worth revisiting maybe in the off season or around that time. Cause
we could do a pretty good whole episode on where does Dylan Larkin rank. Because one of the things that always comes up is people will say, like, because I think they'll just imagine him for a moment on Toronto and say, well, he'd be the 3C on Toronto because Toronto has John Tavares and Austin Matthews.
Right.
And they say, okay, so he's not a top 6 center on a contender just because one contender has 2 of the 10 best centers in the NHL. Right. But I can also look at Vegas and say he'd be the number 1 center in Vegas.
That's fair. And that really goes to show you the number of different ways you can construct a hockey team and be successful in this league. I mean, you look at the Islanders. Did anyone pick the Islanders to lead the East?
He'd be the number 1 center on the Islanders.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's right there.
He'd be the number 1 center on the Stars, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, the Islanders are leading the East Division right now. And that's not something that I think anyone would have thought of. You know, you look in Carolina. I mean, he probably plays behind Aho. You can argue, you know, about where Jordan Staal and where Vincent Trocheck are playing. I mean, Trocheck's obviously had an outstanding season, but he's in the conversation for 2 there. But then you look at some of the other, you know, contending teams, and sure, he's not playing there in Tampa. He's not playing there in Toronto. He's not playing there, you know, in Edmonton, if they ever split up, you know, Drysdale and McDavid, which you never know if they're going to do. So,
right.
You know, all in all, very interesting. Minnesota, probably 1C in Minnesota, right?
Yes. Yep. And I really like Joel Eriksson-Ek, so that's no slander to him. But I do think he'd be number 1 in Minnesota. That's another division leader. So you just get into this interesting dynamic here where there's, in some ways, the dispersal of center talent in the league is not even at all. And so me saying he's a top 30 center, and again, I would say probably more like top 25, doesn't mean that he wouldn't be the 3C on Toronto. He would, unless they move like Tavares to the wing or something. Which might be the smart move, but it could also mean he could be the 1C for a multiple teams that were in the Final 4 last year. So it's an uneven dispersal. So it's a great talking point.
Yeah. And maybe at some point we go through and we take stock of how far the Wings are away with some of the key players.
Yeah. All right. So here's a good one from Lars, which maybe could also be a whole episode. Looking at the amount of expiring contracts, one has to wonder how many rookies can Red Wings fans expect for next season? Because surely the Red Wings can't re-sign everybody who's expiring, right? And he said, right? I think he's a little nervous about whether that could happen. So in part, he wants to know how many rookies can you expect? And then specifically, he wants to know about Chalowski and Svechnikov and whether they'll be in the NHL. I'll tell you right now, we do not know the answer to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's anyone's guess with Chalowski and Svechnikov. And I mean, I think you saw last year the Wings had a handful of expiring contracts that they didn't end up bringing back. You know, Jonathan Erickson didn't come back. Jimmy Howard didn't come back. Handful of other guys, had expiring deals that didn't come back and weren't re-signed. And I think you would expect something similar here. I don't expect Darren Helm to be re-signed. Luke Glendening, if he's not dealt, I would expect to be re-signed. I think Bobby Ryan is anyone's guess. You know, he's expressed interest in wanting to come back, but who knows? And same with Sam Gagner. I mean, he's been an outstanding, I think, depth player for the Wings. Wouldn't mind re-signing him, but you don't know what his career path looks like and if he wants to come back here. I don't think you'll see Mark Stahl or Patrick Nemeth back, but I do think you'd see John Merrill back. And so that leaves you with probably three forward holes up front and arguably two to three forward holes on defense. And who's to say? I mean, you know, the Wings have the ability to fill those with rookies, but I think time after time they've kind of demonstrated that they'll maybe fill one or two with rookies and then kind of bring in a couple of veterans like they did this year with Nemestikov coming in, with Bobby Ryan coming in, with Stetcher and Stahl and then Merrill coming in. So I think probably of those six holes, expect four veterans and maybe two rookies coming up. I don't know. What do you think, Max?
I think that's a very good ballpark. I would be surprised if at any one season in the next few years, you have more than three rookies, true rookies on the team. Now, I'm not going to count Rasmussen as one of those true rookies, not because so much of that 2018-19 season, which I think you can just kind of throw away, but because if he's up now, this will kind of assuage that, right? Like in the same way that Zadina last year, this is Zadina's first full season. I wouldn't call Philip Zadina a rookie, not just because he doesn't have Calder eligibility, but because he got a pretty good run last year that he was coming in differently. So I think Moritz Seider is a virtual lock as a rookie next year. I would put Joe Valeno as better than not chance to play 45 to 50 NHL games. I don't know for sure that he starts and breaks camp with the Red Wings, but I would think that it's a situation similar to Zadina and Rasmussen in the last 2 years where by midseason they're up. So that's two. Don't think it'll be Albert Johansson. Don't think it'll be Lucas Raymond. I don't think it'll be Jonathan Berggren. I'm a little more open to it just because he's older. So he doesn't have the AHL experience, which I ultimately think is what will happen, is they'll go AHL route with him. But it's been 3 years since his draft. So if they want, if there was someone they were really going to try it with and really let someone, have the benefit of the doubt after like a good camp, despite having no AHL experience, my guess is Berggren would be the best candidate for that.
I think he's going to be Jovani Smith if they don't lose him in the expansion draft.
But is he a rookie? Like, same deal. Like,
does he meet the definition? He hasn't played more than 20 games.
He has Calder eligibility, but so, is he like a rookie? Like,
yeah. I mean, he's not in that sense, but I think he also hasn't been given a full-time shot, if you will.
No, I agree. But I just mean, like, when I say three rookies tops, I wouldn't say Jovani Smith's presence would disqualify someone.
If you
want to
talk about him as a rookie, then no. I'm just thinking more like first year full time with the team. Like,
I agree. I agree about that. I think he'll be full time next year.
Yeah. So, like, by my, analogy or the way I'm approaching it, Philip Zadina would be one of those this year. He's not a rookie, but this is his first full year, up with the team. So,
well, maybe it's a better definition, honestly, because I think that would still qualify for, like, you're probably not going to see two players like that. I mean, like, I guess you've seen Zadina and Rasmussen on a line on occasion, but by and large, they haven't used two guys under 22 on the same line in quite some time.
Yeah. You know? So that's where you're thinking maybe it's a Jovani Smith. It's maybe, Joe Valeno gets a shot, and Chalowski maybe gets that shot on defense, and Moritz Seider gets the shot, there, or it's Gustav Lindstrom, one of those two. But I think Seider's definitely the most easily the biggest one that's going to be there. It's just who else is going to be there. I'm not sure, but don't expect rookies to fill all of it.
Are you shining the Chase Pearson bat signal?
I almost did. I almost said it. But then when I saw how they've kind of manipulated the taxi squad throughout the year, I think maybe he's a little further down on their pecking order than I would think, but he's a center, right? So
he's a center. I also think that maybe that's a position that if you have Rasmussen and depending on how they want to introduce Valeno to the NHL, you probably are going to want at least a veteran center in that mix too. Like let's assume the centers next year are in some order Larkin, Nemestikov, Rasmussen, maybe Glendening. But if there's a free agent area of need, like, I don't think center is a bad idea there.
Yeah. I honestly would not be surprised if they pull in a free agent center to come through and play. I mean, that would make a lot of sense here.
Yeah, I think so too. So, and maybe Valeno starts on the wing then. That's where he's been in Sweden lately. That's how Larkin started in the NHL. But, you know, I think the farther along the Red Wings get in this rebuild without Chase Pearson debuting, the more my my prediction is seeing him, I think gets tougher and tougher, because now you're going to have guys like Niederbach coming up. You're going to have Valeno and Rasmussen entrenched and all that jazz. So we'll see how it shakes out. What else do we got here? We've got Phil Roberto wants us to comment on the Red Wing decision makers with respects to call-ups and demotions to and from the farm system. I think he wants to know, is that just a GM decision or is that coaches as well? And what do we make of Svechnikov not being told the reason? I don't know that that's true. Is that something that is out there, or are people just speculating?
No, that came out in the Griffin's post-game conference. Where there's a quote from him saying that he hadn't heard from Yzerman or hadn't heard from Blashill in terms of the reason for being sent down.
I'll have to go watch that. I did not know that.
Yeah, so it's kind of weird. I don't know that it's like as terrible sounding as maybe as it is. I mean, obviously you'd want the guy to know, like, you know, what else you could do in that respect. But I mean, the frustrating part for a lot of people, including some of the players themselves, is hockey is certainly a business, and things like this happen. It shouldn't happen. This is not a way that I would want anyone to ever be treated or felt like. But unfortunately, it seems to be the reality of the way things have operated for a long time. As far as decision makers, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that it's a joint decision between those two. Would you agree, Max?
Yeah, I mean, it's the way that this works is, the coach sets their lineup, that's true, but the coach and GM are in near constant communication over the course of a season. Like, I Yzerman's probably traveling to some degree, I would imagine, to see prospects for the draft, and that's part of this. But by and large, it's a pretty good bet that he and Jeff Blashill are in regular communication about how the team's playing, how different players are playing. I would be stunned if he was ever stunned by a lineup decision, or, you know, like, it's not to say he's going to, you know, but a GM that meddles in the lineup is not a GM you want. Right. So there's kind of a confluence here of try to kind of how to parse this. I think what people are looking for, and the answer here is, who do I blame for Svechnikov being sent down? And I don't think you're going to be able to narrow that down to one person. It's an organization, you know, it's an organizational body that results in something like this.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about organizational philosophies all the time. You either are talking about a fractured organization if there's not that communication and joint buy-in, or you're talking about an organization that works together and therefore it's a joint decision.
And I'm pretty sure it's the latter.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So we've got Lassie Anderson asks, if every player currently on the Red Wings was playing at their peak performance of their entire career, how much better would the Red Wings be? So you're basically getting prime Franz Nielsen, prime Valtteri Filppula, prime Mark Stahl. Who else is pet? Prime Thomas Greiss. You could maybe even bring that up to the younger guy. I mean, can we go forward and put like Filip Zadina in his prime right now? I don't know how to necessarily take this one.
I don't know that I would, just because I don't know what it is.
I mean, okay,
I can maybe reasonably guess
the peak so far.
Yeah, I mean, of peak so far, I think obviously Franz Nielsen and Valtteri Filppula are two huge additions in that regard, because those guys at their peak, I mean, you know, Franz Nielsen was one of the best defensive centers in the NHL and could score a fair bit as well. And then Filppula was, again, a very defensively responsible center who could put up 60 points in a season and, you know, actually played a little first and second line center when he first went to Tampa. So, you know, he absolutely, this team is so much better. I mean, Mark Stahl, his peak was solid prior to the eye injury. So, you know, that's another defenseman you add. To me, it's still an average team. I don't know that this is anything more than maybe a 7 seed in the playoffs.
Yeah, I think they could be a little better than a 7 seed if you give me that kind of center depth, because you have a nice blend there between, Nielsen as the kind of two-way center that he was in his prime, Filppula as the offensive center that he was in his prime, Larkin who does both. I don't know that the wings, I mean, how granular can I go? Can I get like Sam Gagner's 9-point game, Sam Gagner? Like, how granular of a peak can I get to?
I mean, Sam Gagner's peak arguably is in the OHL, right? Where he was one of the 10 best.
Can I get Dennis Cholowski's first month of 2018?
Yeah,
and I mean, just that.
So here's an area, right? So we're talking about three great centers now. You've got Franz Nielsen, you've got Valtteri Filppula, you got Dylan Larkin. Is this team better than present Winnipeg?
No, probably not.
Yeah.
That's a very good point.
Right? I mean, this is a very similar. Now, granted, present day Winnipeg is 17-8-2 and they're second in their division, but they're not better than that team. Yeah, and so then you start to like peck your way down. Yes, they have good center depth, but I don't know that there's enough pieces here for me to be very excited about how good that team would be. I do think they would be a playoff team, but I think they'd be an average playoff team.
You know, they wouldn't be that far off of like a Rangers or a somewhere between Rangers and Philly, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Philly's even a good comparison there. And Philly's fifth in the East right now, 13-9-3. So, you know, I think Philly would be a similar talent team.
Yeah. All right. That's a good one. I like that question from Lassie. Dave, this one's going to be just a complete you question. What is the best bourbon food?
I think it's got to be bourbon covered or bourbon chocolate balls. I mean, if you can get the right bourbon infused in there, that's going to be the key.
Okay. Brandon Johnson, in a trade, would you prioritize picks in this year's draft in hopes that the lack of scouting opportunities increases the chance of hitting with some of the later round picks?
I would prioritize picks in 2022 and 2023, given the overall talent there and the variance between teams not having a good assessment of where they're actually going. You know, we talk about how the lack of scouting may be a hindrance, but I also think it's a uniform hindrance. I don't think any team has consistently demonstrated the ability to be better than one another at identifying talent. So you're basically just getting more shots at the dartboard, which is nice, but I'd rather have more shots in the dartboard in 2022 and 2023.
The one thing I'd say about that, though, is if we're talking about like second and third round picks, what I think this draft lacks is at the very top, and that's where the 22 and 23 drafts shine, is at the very top. If you're talking about second, third round picks, you might be able to kind of make a pretty compelling argument that ultimately the depth areas of drafts probably don't stretch that deep. And it's what makes a great draft is great talent at the top. And so from that standpoint, I think you could make a pretty good case to what I think is Dave is saying. And that's, you know, loading up now because maybe you have a chance for some unseen talent to slip where, you know, the 2022 draft does seem like it's going to have some really high end talent at the top, but it might not actually be any deeper than this year.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's reasonable to say that in really in any given year, I mean, you're talking about maybe 50 players make the league.
And a lot of them go in the top two rounds, but some of them always go in the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, we'll see. I mean, it's there's not necessarily a uniform distribution. Your best chance to land them, obviously, is first and second rounds. And your best chance to land the best players are in the first and second round. But there's always guys that slip and fall and get through the cracks. And so, you know, getting more picks this year gives you more opportunities to land them. But question is, can you actually identify them, you know, and pick them at the right spot?
Yeah. All right. And then Zeebs asks, what would the return for Bernier need to be to justify not re-signing him? In other words, you know, if you assume that Bernier has been really good and good enough to like kind of earn a contract extension from the Red Wings, what does some other GM have to tell you on the phone when he calls you between now and April 12th to go, all right, we'll have to take our chances at free agency to try and get him back?
Yeah. I mean, as much as I talk about goaltending kind of being a position that can easily be addressed in free agency, Bernier is a guy who has demonstrated the ability to play at a high level behind this team. And, you know, while the statistics have sort of suggested that goaltenders are relatively replaceable and you can sort of interchange them in that average to above average tier, I do wonder if there is something that's missed in that analysis. And particularly, there was a great article. I can't remember, you know, which goalie scout was talking about this. So apologies for not being able to quote it appropriately. But talking about how a goalie controls their rebounds, how a goalie learns to redirect pucks and which pucks should be directed to which areas of the ice should be supported by their defense. And, you know, the depth they play in their crease is impacted by what the defensive scheme and structure is like. And so perhaps there are certain goalies that are going to play better in certain systems. And maybe that's the case with Jonathan Bernier. Maybe he's a guy that just needed whatever Detroit does for him to really bring out the best of his game. And so if you've got a nice match there and he's not expensive, then I'd certainly keep him here.
Did you take a third round pick?
No.
You should take a second round pick straight up.
2022 second.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Acting Secretary Malarkey, you're in charge of hockey on ESPN, which I have not been asked to do, just for full disclosure. What does your broadcast look like? Who do you have in the studio and who do you have in the booths?
Well, I grew up on ESPN hockey. So the theme song is now blaring as we're going along here. So for me, the announcer, the lead announcer has to be Gary Thorne. I mean, every memorable hockey call that has ever existed from the 90s and early 2000s is by Gary Thorne. And so if he is interested, I am absolutely having him on the broadcast team. I thought Bill Clement was a great partner for him, but I think Bill Clement is officially retired. And so, you know, you'd have to kind of think through some of the color analysts across the league and who would be great here. You know, Razor, who does the Dallas games, I think is a great color guy. I think he's done a really nice, I think Daryl Razor is his first name, if I remember right. He's an excellent color guy. I think AJ Malesko is a great color analyst as well. So she'd be another awesome person to have in the booth. And then in the studio, I think Steve Levy's got to run that just to, again, give me my old timey feel there. And Kevin Weeks, I think, has done a nice job as well. So he'd be another interesting guy to have in the booth there. And, you know, potentially you can get Cammy Granato to, or not Cammy Granato, Haley Wickenheiser or either one of those if they, you know, can abandon some team duties and pitch in a little bit. I don't know if either one of them are allowed to do that, but I always appreciated, you know, hearing from them. So I think that'd round out kind of an interesting broadcast team.
I really like all of that. Can I add one crazy Galaxy brain one?
Yes.
I want to, if I'm in charge of ESPN, I am luring Bobby Ryan into retirement by paying him more than the $1 million NHL teams are paying him to play to be one of my studio analysts. He is so good in interviews. I imagine that would translate perfectly to TV. He's thoughtful. He's personable. You look at what Kevin Bieksa is like on Hockey Night in Canada, and they don't quite necessarily have like the same, I don't see they'd be like the exact same profile, but I like having that really recently retired player in the studio giving analysis who has played with some of these guys, played against a lot of these guys, and just brings a really fun dynamic to the broadcast. So if I'm in charge of ESPN, I am luring Bobby Ryan into retirement to join the studio audience with more than $1 million contract.
That would be, that'd be a lot of fun in the studio because unfortunately, you know, as much as I would like, you know, Cammy Granato and Haley Wickenheiser in there, just as for how thoughtful they are, you know, their team roles are certainly going to preclude them from participating as much as I would like that. So, you know, Bobby Ryan would be another fun guy to have in there. I think Cassie Campbell-Pascal is another great analyst in there as well. Sure. So I think you could really put together a pretty incredible team. You know, if you when you said you had a Galaxy brand idea, I thought you were going to say Stephen A. Smith. And then
what I actually did consider saying is Snoop Dogg, who has done some color for games
for the LA Kings.
It's a blast. Yes. Yeah.
His color for the LA Kings was hilarious.
Hilarious.
Absolutely hilarious.
But the one problem that they would run into with it is there's a lot of kind of traditionalists who I think would not like be open to having as much fun as that is. You know what I mean?
So here's the thing, right? What has tradition got you? It's got you the fourth or fifth rated major sport, right?
Great point.
Right? Gee, Stephen A. Smith, I saw a lot of people pushing back against him commenting about hockey.
That video was so fun.
But his video was hilarious and his reach is amazing. He is a guy that gets people to talk about the sport. Yeah. So to me, screw tradition. Like, as I say this, as I just said, I want Gary Thorne and Steve Levy in the booth because I think both those guys did a great job in bringing a lot of fans in. But you have to mix the other part of the broadcast team with guys and girls who buck tradition. Like, you know, give me Stephen A. Smith, who is in there. You know, I bet Doris Burke could call a hockey game. I would listen to Doris Burke talk about anything. Yeah. I bet you could get her to call a hockey game as a color analyst, and she would do a fantastic job. So, you know, to me, screw tradition. Like, let's get some different blood in there and get some people just talking about the sport.
Yeah. The other one I wanted to add, she's already with ESPN, so I'm sure she will be part of the coverage, and that's Emily Kaplan, who yes. I think is one of the best hockey journalists working right now. She's
also very captivating. The video she narrated for ESPN as a part of as I always forget, Outside the Lines? I can't remember.
Yep.
Right now, of course, as I'm put on the spot. But yeah, she's also very captivating to listen to.
Yep. All right. And then we're going to close on this one because we're running the time like crazy right now. Adam Izaguirre, you're going to love this one. SAT analogy, rebuilding Colorado is to Matt Duchene as current Red Wings are to which player?
Oh, you're going to love my answer. It's Philip Peronic.
Okay.
Guy perceived to be better than he actually is and could net you some reasonable amount of assets.
I thought you were going to go with one of Mantha or Bertuzzi.
No, because Mantha is actually good and Bertuzzi's providing some much needed scoring this year. Tyler Bertuzzi would have been my answer if he asked me this question last year. Now I'm going to hit pause because I want to see some more games from him. Philip Peronic's my answer.
I thought it was going to be one of those guys because those are the guys who I think, you know, they're kind of on that older edge of that thing that Duchene would have kind of aged out of Colorado's. You know, they're right now they're in their window and you're seeing Duchene start to decline. So I thought that was going to be where you were going to go with that. But that's an interesting one. I mean, I don't think that's a bad, you know, I think Hronek is better than you think he is. And that's just a fact of the show that we constantly have to navigate around. But I don't think it's the worst. Like if someone fell in love with Philip Hronek and they wanted to trade him, I don't think that's like unjustifiable.
Yeah. I mean, I think he certainly nets you less than what you got with Matt Duchene. I mean, that's going to be abundantly clear, but in terms of like the phenotype of the player that I think their perception is maybe a little greater than what they actually are. I think he maybe fits that the best.
Leading the team in scoring right now, despite having some pretty rough shot luck.
Yeah, I mean, it's impressive. It's impressive that he has managed to rack up all of these secondary assists.
Cutting backhand remark. We'll close on that. All right, everybody. We will be back at you later this week. Red Wings have another game against the Lightning, and then they're going to have a series against, who are they playing, Dallas?
Yep, Dallas is next.
Yep. And, of course, March Madness is here. And starting on Tuesday, March 16th, the Athletics College Basketball Crew brings you The Ding You, presented by BetMGM. We'll cover all the action, both on the court and at the sportsbook, grab an insight from the Athletics College basketball writers, and picking the brain of BetMGM's top bookmakers. Tournament preview show is Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Daily Ding feed and streaming on YouTube. We'll talk to you on Wednesday.